What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Sally Prezand, the first woman ordained a rabbi in America. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Too Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish. Shalom. In the wake of the nominating conventions, both Republican and Democratic, the past 2 weeks, and although there are strong Jewish advocates for the major party presidential candidates on both sides in this election year, it is nonetheless clear that many people are not strongly or positively drawn to either one. Disillusionment with the American political process and the sound and fury that always accompanies it might lead some of you out there in the Too Jewish listening audience to decide not to vote. Well, freedom, the ability to choose whom we prefer in governing, is a great gift that many people around the world still do not possess. As Jews, members of a religion that highly values free will, we must be cognizant of the fact that America remains an incredibly good place for us, and we should always exercise our right and responsibility to vote. Voting matters as an expression of our freedom, as a demonstration of our civic responsibility. We need to vote. Even if we might be voting less than enthusiastically for president this time around. There's another area in which we have full freedom to choose and for which we bear responsibility, too. It is in how we express our Judaism, the ways in which we act out our beliefs, practices, ethics, and tradition. Being Jewish in America is a choice. When we choose to embrace Judaism fully, exploring its wisdom, joy, and purpose, we add beauty and meaning to our lives. Being Jewish is a gift, and embracing that gift is a particular privilege. We Jews connect to our heritage through prayer, study, discussion, and caring acts. We can connect to our peoplehood through food, music, literature, and culture. Synagogues, like my own Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, provide a wealth of opportunities for prayer, learning, community, for service. You can choose to join for Shabbat services on a Friday or Saturday, enroll in an adult education course, assist on a social action project, or volunteer to help another Jew by becoming part of a caring community. You can even combine prayer and eating at an Onig Shabbat or a Shabbat dinner, or combine learning and eating at a rabbi's tish, a study session, in a uniquely Jewish way. Invite friends and acquaintances to join you in those Jewish actions. Enhance their lives, too. When you choose to make Judaism an important part of your life and do so with energy and commitment, well, now you are truly voting your conscience. In this election year, I can make you a promise that's easy to keep. If you vote to be more actively Jewish, your life will definitely improve in meaningful ways. Won't you make that choice? It might well be better than the one we get for president. To play us in this morning on the theme of celebrating the joy of Judaism, here's Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, Serve God with Joy, sung by my dad and me on our CD, Generation to Generation. Ivdu et Hashem, Ivdu et Hashem, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, Ivdu et Hashem. Shem Besimcha. That was Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rabbi Sally Prezand, was the very first woman rabbi ever ordained at a seminary here in America way back in 1972. Meet a vital woman and an excellent rabbi who is truly a historical figure when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Sally Prezand was America's first female rabbi ordained by Hebrew Union College. She is retired now. They've recently published, slightly late for the 40th anniversary of her ordination, a volume exploring the role of women in the rabbinate. Pleasure, really kind of a thrill to have you. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you so much.
So I've always wanted to ask you this. You know, sometimes people that are pioneers intended to be pioneers and are excited about that prospect. I'm not sure that was true for you, was it?
No, it was not. I did not intend to be a pioneer. I wasn't trying to champion women's rights. I just wanted to be a rabbi. And so for me, some of the responsibilities that come along with being the first and being a pioneer were difficult because I'm a very private person, and it's, I guess, the paradox of my personality that I chose such a public profession.
When did you decide you wanted to be a rabbi?
I decided when I was 16 years old. It was back in 1962. And fortunately for me, my parents gave me what I consider to be one of the greatest gifts that a parent can give a child, and that is the courage to dare and to dream. And they didn't plant in my mind any doubts. They said, if this is what you want, then you should do it.
Now, your dad was an engineer, your mom was active as a volunteer, but nothing about that says, oh, she's automatically going to be the first female rabbi.
No, not really. We were very active in our synagogue. Actually, I was originally brought up in a conservative synagogue. And I remember we moved to the west side of Cleveland where there's only one congregation, and it happened to be Reform, so we joined it. And my parents were always very involved, and I was involved in youth group, etc. But I do remember going to the synagogue during the first few months and seeing a woman read from the Torah, and frankly, I thought that was terrible. I could not believe that that was happening because I really had not seen that at my conservative synagogue. And I developed a wonderful feeling for Jewish ritual, which has remained with me. I went to the Union camp in Zionsville, Indiana. I had received a scholarship from my temple. I was supposed to go that summer to the Girl Scout Roundup in Colorado, but my temple chose me to go to camp, and I did, and I know that was a tipping point in my life. And of course, one of the lessons that it teaches us is that Jewish camp is good for Jewish kids.
It's a great, fascinating beginning. We will talk much more with Rabbi Sally Prezand, the first woman rabbi ordained in America at a seminary, when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Lots more to talk about. We welcome our friends from Freedom of Smoke, David and Pamela. You guys focus so much on your customers. Tell us why they're so important to you.
Our customers are extremely important to us. It's why we built this company. Our job is to get people to quit smoking, and we're extremely good at it. You can come in a very nice, comfortable lounge environment, try anything you want to try. You'll have knowledgeable and helpful staff that will be happy to get you or your family and loved ones to quit smoking.
We have 4 locations in Tucson, 1 in Catalina on the Pinal border, and our latest store has just opened in Sierra Vista.
And these are all lounges, sort of a comfortable environment for people to come in.
Yes, they're set up with couches and pool tables, pinball machines, video games, anything to help you along with your time.
What's the best way for people to find out more information?
They can go onto our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call our toll-free hotline for any information that you want, 1-800-705-7013.
And that number again is?
1-800-705-7013.
Thanks so much. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Thankfully, we only have about 3 months until we elect a new president of the United States. We continue now with our 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. In advance of the Democratic Party's nominating convention in Philadelphia last week, the highest-ranking Jewish member of the Democratic establishment, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, head of the Democratic National Committee, chair of the whole convention, at least originally, took perhaps the quickest and hardest fall we have seen from a position of such influence. Just before the convention was to begin, and immediately after the Republican convention concluded, WikiLeaks published a collection of emails indicating that Wasserman Schultz and other members of the DNC staff showed bias against the presidential campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders and in favor of Hillary Clinton's campaign. Perhaps the most damaging leak came from a Wasserman Schultz staffer who proposed highlighting the supposed fact that Sanders, Clinton's adversary, was an atheist who was estranged from his Jewish background, which would be especially damaging to him in southern states. In fact, Sanders is actually an agnostic, not an atheist, and proud of being Jewish. Anyway, after the leaks were broadcast, Wasserman Schultz agreed to resign her position as chairperson of the DNC after the 2016 Democratic National Convention. At first, she refused to surrender her right to speak and gavel in the convention. Then she was actually booed off the stage by members of her own Florida delegation and changed her mind. After her resignation, she was immediately enlisted by Hillary Clinton as honorary chair of her campaign, whatever that means. Wasserman Schultz is known as the Jewish mother of Congress and might be the most Jewishly identified representative of Congress or the Senate. Controversies swirled around the source of the WikiLeaks information on the internal emails of the Democratic National Committee. Apparently, Russian hackers, perhaps under the direction of Vladimir Putin himself, obtained the emails and released them last week strategically to damage the Democratic Party's chances in November. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump invited Russia to retrieve missing emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign and release them. Cybersecurity experts describe Trump's remarks as unprecedented and possibly illegal. Even more fun. Deborah Wasserman Schultz previously was the co-chair of Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful presidential campaign in 2008. Well, she's out of this one now. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about colonialism for the last couple of weeks, looked at the Dutch and Belgians, talked last week about the British and French. Let's look at colonialism, you know, kind of right here at home in our hemisphere.
Well, closer to home, of course, the Brits and the French were also in a rivalry in North America, both in what eventually became the United States, most of which we bought from France in the Louisiana Purchase, and in Canada, which to this day is bilingual and sort of bicultural because the French were massively present in eastern Canada and the Brits in the west. But the more interesting colonial heritage and more durable, particularly in terms of language, is in what we vaguely call Latin America. And we call it that way because part of it is Portuguese-speaking and part of it is Spanish-speaking. We here in Arizona live in a territory that was once part of New Spain. And the Spanish brought the Inquisition, they brought Catholicism, they brought missions and priests and the Spanish language.
And by the way, a lot of conversos, a lot of secret Jews came with the Spanish because they fled in 1492 or thereafter and ended up in the Western Hemisphere.
Right. And one thing I think a lot of people may not know is why one significant chunk of Latin America speaks Portuguese rather than Spanish. Brazil,
where the Olympics are held.
Right. And a very wealthy country in terms of natural resources, human resources, territory. It's quite an important country. Why does it speak Portuguese? Because at a certain point during the rivalry to build empires, the Pope drew a line and said everything east of this line belongs to Portugal and everything west belongs to Spain. Well, the line inconveniently went down the middle of what eventually became Brazil. So the Portuguese basically got all of Brazil and it became Portuguese speaking, whereas virtually all the rest of South America and most of Central America, with a few minor exceptions, were Spanish speaking.
And a little bit of North America, New Mexico, of course.
Right. So, I mean, there is, you know, Belize, which is English-speaking. There's definitely some islands in the Caribbean that belong to everybody. Even Denmark had an island in the Caribbean. And there are little chunks on the northeast corner of South America, one of which is Dutch-speaking, one of which is French-speaking, and right. One of which is British-speaking, English-speaking. But apart from that, papal politics and intra-Catholic politics basically determined that the vast majority of Latin America would be either Portuguese-speaking or Spanish-speaking. The Portuguese, of course, at one time had a serious colonial empire in India, in the Far East, and particularly in Africa. They had some pretty big, important chunks of territory, including but not limited to Mozambique and Angola and a couple other smaller places. And today, we think of Portugal as kind of a small backwater, but it has this rich colonial history, and it's certainly left a vivid legacy in all of these countries. So colonialism, not necessarily always a bad thing. Certainly, I mean, at best, maybe a mixed bag. But almost all the countries we know were once colonies of somebody else.
You know, it's kind of remarkable. We tend to forget America wasn't born, you know, like out of Zeus's head all at once. We were a British colony and a lot of other pieces mixed in. And it's important in this summer, I think, particularly remember our legacy, not just as a colony, but as a collecting point for everybody. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Israel, to outsiders, must be living in a perpetual state of crisis. It's either a terror attack or an economic crisis or the government's in a mess. And yet, Israelis don't seem fazed by this at all.
Yeah, I think it's, first of all, feels for the Israelis, for me for sure, but for most of the Israelis, that we are living the dreams, the dream of our, you know, fathers and grandfathers. So first of all, we're feeling blessed. And I think we feel like we're powerful. We feel like we have the power. Someone is protecting us and give us the power and the mifchanim, like the testing us. But the test, he's testing us and give us the power to
overcome it.
Overcome this test. But let's give more realistic examples. If it's the early 50s when it was Tkufat HaTzena, and you will help me to translate Tkufat HaTzena, when there was no food, okay?
Yeah, it was a time of shortage.
Because it was so many new immigrants.
Right.
And we just didn't have not enough.
Yeah, the population nearly doubled in a few years, and the people who came often came with nothing.
Bidiuk. And we need food, the basic. I'm not talking about houses. They lived in tents, but so
there was rationing of lots of things for a while.
Nachon.
Years.
So Like, for instance, rice was too expensive, so we invented the Israeli couscous. That's right. Why we have Israeli couscous. It was in the shape of a rice at the beginning.
Which is world famous and delicious, Israeli couscous.
And now you have tons of recipes. But back then, it was made from flour, very delicious. And back then, they cooked it only with, you know, water and salt. But today, you can find, like, tons of different recipes, and you can combine it with
It was out of necessity they invented
it. Exactly. And then let's talk about, you know, if it was the lack of water in Israel, so we invented and we are number one, like in irrigation system, in the world, in irrigation system.
In drip irrigation, particularly desert irrigation.
Definitely.
Right, water usage.
And in general, all the water researches, like how to, you know, whatever it relates to water, I think we're number one.
You know, I'm thinking about how Israel's had to be so focused on security, bitachon, and that included computer security to make sure their high tech was secure. And now Israel's number one in the world at providing computer security systems.
Computer security, border security.
Right.
You know,
border security, avionics, lots of things. Mm-hmm. By necessity, they had to learn
by
how to
necessity.
Be really good.
Yeah, and in general, and I know we talked about it before, but all the high tech in all aspect, we become like, I think we're not rated as number one anymore, we're number two. But I think for 8 million people country,
Number two
enough.
In the world in high-tech development is pretty impressive. You know, it's not, it's more like Silicon Valley in the Middle East, only it really is. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. So maybe crisis is opportunity in Israel if it's handled
it's
that way.
It's not only crisis, it's opportunity. Definitely. I don't want to say, I don't want to conclude this session and say that we like crisis, but I think Israeli really know how to manage crisis and to get, you know, the best of it most of the time.
The best results. Thanks, Oshra.
Toda,
hopefully,
Rabbi.
Not too many more crises. Mamash. And continue to manage.
Toda.
We'll talk next week. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe walks into the local bar and sees his friend Moshe sitting at the bar. He puts his hand to his heart and yells, "Oy vey, Moshe, I'm so sorry to hear about your factory burning down." Moshe whirls around and whispers, "Shh, you idiot. It's tomorrow." You see, he was trying to collect the insurance money and... That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, Maaseh, includes the final chapters of the Book of Numbers. In the concluding section of Bamidbar, an important and unusual institution is created. It's called the City of Refuge, Ir Miklat. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was typically accomplished by the family of the victim. What we would probably consider vigilante action was the normal means of addressing the moral and social disruption created by a killing. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed thought you had done the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. It was like the Hatfields and the McCoys. Kill and be killed. Then your family will avenge the killing, and the other family will respond in kind, and on it went. That meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing truly was accidental, even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help much. And so in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge to be created in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet, the Torah established this principle 3,000 years ago or so. Perhaps more importantly, in this section of Maaseh, the central requirement to try a capital case in Jewish law is established. A murderer may not be put to death, save by the eyewitness testimony of two adult witnesses. This is a much more stringent standard than that used by any death penalty court in America today. Murder, the deliberate taking of human life, is the most serious of crimes and must be fully punished according to Judaism. But that punishment can only be meted out after an extremely careful process. The use of lynch mobs is outmaneuvered by the creation of cities of refuge. Proper witnesses must be secured to give evidence. A trial of law before appropriately qualified judges must be instituted before any punishment for murder may be applied. While halacha provides for the death penalty in cases of premeditated murder, it makes it extremely difficult to enforce that punishment. The Mishnah teaches that a court that passes a death penalty once in 7 years is considered bloodthirsty. Other prominent rabbis extend that to once in 70 years, or ever. In other words, the ultimate punishment must be reserved for a nearly perfect case. Otherwise, only lesser forms of remediation can be applied. And since we are human, our cases are usually far less than perfect. Jewish law makes it clear that justice, especially for the worst crimes, must be careful, exacting, and scrupulously ethical, and that we should never rush to embrace the gravest punishment as some sort of simple solution to society's problems. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Sally Prizan, the historical figure who was the very first woman rabbi ever ordained in America in 1972, will tell us what she's learned over the course of her remarkable career as a reluctant pioneer. Find out when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Jewish former mayor of New York, billionaire Michael Bloomberg, spoke at the Democratic National Convention. He urged independents to vote for Hillary Clinton, saying Donald Trump was a risky, reckless, and radical choice. I know what it's like to have neither party represent my views or values, the former three-term New York mayor said. There are times when I disagree with Hillary Clinton, Bloomberg continued, but whatever our disagreements may be, I've come here to say we must put them aside for the good of our country. We must unite around the candidate who can defeat a dangerous demagogue. Bloomberg's appearance was unusual at this convention, coming from a former Democrat who was less than full-throated in his endorsement of Clinton. Bloomberg, the media magnate, took aim at the purported business chops of the developer and reality star. Throughout his career, Trump has left behind a well-documented record of bankruptcies, thousands of lawsuits, angry shareholders and contractors who feel cheated, disillusioned customers who feel ripped off, Bloomberg said. Trump says he wants to run the nation like he's run his business. God help us. Bloomberg indulged in the blunt New Yorkisms that have made him a very popular mayor, and that have also driven part of Trump's popularity. They had the same effect for Bloomberg among Democrats as they've had for Trump with Republicans, applause and laughter. He says he wants to put Americans back to work, but he games the U.S. visa system so he can hire temporary foreign workers at low wages, Bloomberg said. He says he wants to deport 11 million undocumented people, but he seems to have no problem hiring them. What did I miss here? Truth be told, the richest thing about Donald Trump is his hypocrisy. Jews were prominently featured in a number of speaking slots at the convention in Philadelphia, in which Senator Al Franken, comedian Sarah Silverman, actresses Deborah Messing and Lena Dunham, singer Idina Menzel, and many Jewish politicians, including Senator Barbara Boxer and Senator Chuck Schumer, spoke for Hillary Clinton. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords of Arizona, a friend and frequent past guest of Too Jewish, had a great impact on the convention with her own brief remarks. At the Republican convention in Cleveland last week, the star Jewish turn was taken by Ivanka Trump, Donald Trump's Jewish daughter, whose speech posted the highest positive response of any at the whole Republican convention. In Gaza, Hamas is digging more than 6 miles of tunnels leading from Gaza to Israel each month. And some of these terror tunnels are undetectable, Israeli defense and diplomatic officials said last week. We have no perfect solution to the threat, officials told the press, and neither does any country. While there have been numerous reports in recent months of ongoing tunnel digging and Israel destroying some of the tunnels, this appeared to be the first public estimate quantifying the threat. Back in May, Israel's Shin Bet Security Service said it had acquired extensive information on terror tunnels from Gaza terrorists that it had detained. Investigators learned about the tunnel excavators' work methods, tools, and procedures. For example, diggers use a variety of methods to disguise their activity, such as a prohibition on exiting tunnels in work clothes. Excavators are required to shower and change clothes inside the tunnels. The Shin Bet also said last August that Hamas is monitoring Israeli activity to locate the tunnels while it builds them.
This is for Ron Popeil. Made lunch with my Vegematic. Dinner in the rotisserie. Had some jerky from the dehydrator. The pasta was flowing free. I keep a fishing rod in my pocket. Got some knives that were quite a deal. Soon I'll be frying my turkey in olive oil. Thanks to Ron Popeil. With America's inventor. Never know what's in store. And just when you think it's finished, Ron Popeil says, but wait, there's more. Proud to be your friend, Ron.
The inventor of the infomercial and many, many gadgets, ranging from the Veg-O-Matic to the Showtime rotisserie to the pocket fisherman to Mr. Microphone, Ron Popeil, a Jewish guy from New York by way of Florida and Chicago who made good in a big way. Ron Popeil died last week. Popeil invented the phrase, but wait, there's more, and his company, Ronco, was a staple, some would say the bane, of late-night TV in the 60s and 70s. He was parodied, much parodied, and praised, but no one ever sold more kitchen gadgets, upwards of $1 billion worth, than Ron Popeil.
I need a Vegematic. I need a pocket fisherman.
But wait, this time there is no more. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
Our brothers, our brothers.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Rabbi Sally Prezen, the first female rabbi ordained in America at a seminary from Hebrew Union College. She was an extraordinary pioneer, although, as we discussed earlier, not necessarily by intent. She just wanted to be a rabbi. The conservative movement, you mentioned growing up first at a conservative synagogue and then seeing a woman called to the Torah and being kind of shocked by the experience. The conservative movement was not egalitarian in the early 1960s, and even bat mitzvah was sometimes a new feature there. The reform movement was kind of egalitarian, but there weren't women rabbis, weren't women cantors. What persuaded you that you wanted to really choose to do that after you'd gone to camp and sort of gotten introduced to reform experience?
Well, I think it was my love for ritual, for Jewish life, my belief in God, wanting to do something to help the Jewish people survive. And, of course, in the end, really, it was wanting to be a teacher. I always wanted to be whatever my favorite subject was, a math teacher, an English teacher, a French teacher, and in the end, I decided to be a teacher of Judaism, which really is what a rabbi is.
Now, you went to the joint program that HUC had, may still have, I don't know, with the University of Cincinnati, and then applied for the rabbinical school. Tell us what the original responses were from HUC.
Well, originally I applied. It was a joint program. I think my year was the last year of that program.
Right.
But going to the University of Cincinnati meant that I could also take courses across the street at Hebrew Union College, and it enabled me to skip the first year of rabbinic school. So one day I was an undergraduate, and the next day I was in the second year of the rabbinic program, and everybody kind of sat up and took notice and said, "She's still here." I think that they really thought I came to marry a rabbi rather than be a rabbi. And actually, I remember once I had been dating one of my fellow students for a very long time, and a professor went up to him and said, "Well, my boy, when are you going to do the school a favor, marry her and get rid of her?" So, you know, generally, I was very fortunate because Dr. Nelson Glick, Alav HaShalom, was the president of the College Institute at that time, and he wanted to ordain a woman. And so when you look back at the whole process, this was a decision of the college and the other branches of our movement, the CCAR and the URJ or UAHC at that time. They had nothing to say about it. And unfortunately, Dr. Glick died the year before I was ordained. But Fred Gottschalk carried on, and Dr. Gottschalk, and it's only in recent years that I came to understand how much pressure he was under not to ordain me,
right,
even though I had only 1 year left. And it's only recently that I've come to understand how much courage it took for him to step into someone else's shoes and fulfill someone else's mission and dream.
Yeah, I have to tell you a family history piece. My grandmother in the beginning of the 20th century took the train to Cincinnati from Portland and applied to rabbinical school and was turned down. Somewhere we still have the letter. And
wow.
She did that, you know, UC program and eventually married my grandfather, who was a Reform rabbi. As you mentioned, you know, why don't you marry her and take her out of this program? There was a possibility of a woman rabbi much earlier, but I don't think Hebrew Union College or the American Rabbinate was quite ready for it. When you were clearly progressing through the rabbinical program, there must have been resistance along the way, besides kind of offhand comments. What was the experience like for you, as opposed to the people
well,
like Fred Gottschalk?
Well, you know, there were, of course, people who felt that women should not be ordained, and they used to give me all the reasons why. And quite frankly, I listened, And then I would say, thank you for sharing your opinion, and I'd just walk away. I really didn't believe that arguing was the way to go about it. I just had to do it. I was in my class, there were 35 men and me, and I felt very much part of the class. And in the book, The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate, which I'm really so excited about, there is a chapter written by one of my classmates with comments from my classmates about how they felt having me there. During the last year of school, Dr. Glick began to arrange for me to go, it was really, I guess, the second last year, to go around and start speaking so that people could see me. And when I was away, my classmates always taped the classes for me so that I wouldn't miss anything. And then, of course, on the day of ordination, they very spontaneously stood up when I was called to the Bema. That's a very special memory that I cherish. So there were, you know, there. My advisor, here's an example. My advisor met with me every single time I came back from my student pulpit, read every sermon I ever wrote, made comments, and his name was Dr. Eugene Mahaly.
Yes.
Alav HaShalom. Also, he was against the idea of women rabbinate, but changed his mind, and he actually came to install me in my first pulpit at Stephen Wise Free Synagogue in New York.
Tell us about getting out in the field. There's an interview process where we get ordained as rabbis, and then there's what some people call the meat market, but there's a process of being hired. It's complicated. How was that experience for you? Did you experience much resistance specifically?
Yes, I did. And I was the last person in my class to get a job, but I always thought I got the best job. And that was at Stephen Wise Free Synagogue because I felt that it had a reputation for equality and social justice. And frankly, all the other all of my other classmates already had a job, so I was the one who was left. But going through the interview process, there were congregations that wanted me for my publicity value.
Right.
And there were other congregations that just wouldn't accept a woman. And, you know, that went on for several years. I stayed at the Free Synagogue for 7 years, probably a little bit longer than I should have. I, quite frankly, was hoping that when Rabbi Klein retired, I would be given an opportunity to be the senior rabbi.
Right.
That wasn't going to happen. And when I left for the next 2 years, it was very difficult to find a position. I ended up taking a part-time position at Temple Beth El in Elizabeth, New Jersey. I went there just for the weekends. And then during the week, I was a chaplain at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. So it was difficult, and you know, to tell you the truth, I'll tell you a funny story. I remember having a telephone interview with the congregation, and I thought it went very well. And we got done, and they forgot to hang up the phone.
Hey.
So being human,
you listened.
I listened. And what I heard them say was, she sounded terrific, very intelligent, et cetera, et cetera. She would be great. But let's face it, we can't have a woman.
Aye.
So I, because I was the first to be ordained, I was also the first to face all the challenges along the way.
You know, it's such a different environment now. And the book, The Sacred Calling, which is such a kind of a fascinating book and a wide variety of perspectives on women in the rabbinate. Today, when you look at the rabbinate, it's substantially, a very substantial portion is female in the Reform movement. There's even a solid proportion in the conservative movement, and something I never thought would happen until long after the Messiah came. There have even been modern Orthodox women ordained.
Right, and don't forget the Reconstruction.
And the Reconstruction.
They were second.
They were a close second, I might add. They were pretty quick. How does it feel to look out at that and realize you were the very first?
Well, I'm proud of the fact that I was able to open a new door of opportunity for women, and especially for little girls. You know, I think that's, again, I think I said before that I feel that there are some people who have to talk about doing something, then there are some people who have to actually do it. And I see myself in that category. And I remember the first time I went to an ordination service, not that many years after I was ordained, at the New York campus. There were more women in the class than men who were being ordained, and I just, I quelled a lot.
Absolutely. Will we come to a time when people don't really think about the gender of the rabbi, or is that a goal that we shouldn't be looking for?
No, I think that that women rabbis have been accepted, but there are still things that have to be done. There is a problem with equality in terms of salary. We did a survey a few years back which told us that women rabbis generally receive only 80% of what male rabbis receive. And so that's something that we still definitely have to work on. It shows that women rabbis aren't any different than women in the rest of society, where we're still working on that. And quite frankly, I'm a very big supporter of Hillary Clinton, and I'm hoping that when she becomes president, that too is going to open another door that's very important for young girls, knowing they can grow up to be anything, even president of the United States. So we have the salary issue, which we're working on a national level, too. And fortunately, in recent years, many more women have been chosen to be the senior rabbi of large congregations, and that's very important. Took a long time for that to happen.
It did.
And not everybody wants to be the rabbi of a large congregation. I, for example, always thought it was my obligation because I was the first. And when I came to Monmouth Reformed Temple, where I was privileged to be for 25 years, we all thought I was just going to be here for a few years. But my congregation taught me that success doesn't mean bigger. It means, are we doing better today than we did yesterday? And they encouraged me to have ideas, to experiment, to be creative, and they came along with me. And I was always particularly pleased that they accepted me as rabbi, not as the first woman rabbi.
So now, from the perspective of a retired rabbi, having completed your, official tenure at Monmouth Reform and throughout your career, with this really interesting, I think remarkable book about women in the rabbinate, is there something distinctly different about a woman rabbi beyond the obvious biological difference?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that women have brought to the rabbinate. First of all, when I was growing up, at least, the rabbi was really like the ultimate authority, and the rabbi made all the decisions for everybody else. I think that feminism has encouraged us to rethink those models of leadership and has really opened the doors to partnership and networking. I think that's really important. Of course, female rabbis have encouraged us to discover new models of divinity, to remember that God embodies characteristics both masculine and feminine. And so that, too, has impacted all of our liturgy that's created today and new rituals that have been created. All of that is important. We've learned, we've brought in new leaders. We've made leaders more gender aware and brought to our institutions of higher learning respected female scholars who can share valuable lessons and insights that are really unique to women. And we've created all these new role models and allowed to be heard often for the first time. The stories of those whose voices have been silenced for too long. The countless number of women who have enriched our people from biblical times on. And for me, in The Sacred Calling, one of the chapters that that I most admire is the one about Regina Jonas, who right. was really the first woman rabbi.
First woman rabbi in Germany who was ordained and eventually perished in the Holocaust. But
That is correct. And year before last, several of us had an opportunity to go to Germany to follow in her footsteps and to dedicate a plaque in her memory at Terezin.
I might add, and that was reported here on Too Jewish.
Okay, that's good.
It's been such a pleasure having Rabbi Sally Prezand on. And I should note, she mentioned the first Reconstructionist woman, Rabbi Sandy Eisberg Sasso, was also on Too Jewish. And we had Sarah Hurwitz, who was ordained by Maharat. So we've had a lot of the first women rabbis. I think it's really a privilege, but a particular privilege to have you on today, Sally. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Seth Limmer, winner of the URJ Eisendrath Bearer of Light Award for creating a remarkable walk for justice last summer from Selma, Alabama to Washington, D.C. Rabbi Limmer will discuss what racial justice means for American Jews today. Our playout this morning comes from a most interesting group called the Fifth House Ensemble and a new CD entitled Nidudim, an 18th century Sephardic song from them called La Esclava, the Slave. It's about two sisters, one enslaved, the other a queen, who both give birth to children from the same king. And then they meet. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.